University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Werner Fornos, president of the Population Institute, Washington, D.C. His lecture is entitled, Gaining People, Losing Ground. Fornos joined the Population Institute in 1978 and became its president in 1982. The Institute is a nonprofit corporation whose goal is to educate the American public and assist Congress in formulating a policy on the population problem. He has consulted on population programs for the United States Agency Health Association and worked on family planning projects for Tunisia, China, Pakistan, Mexico, and other countries. A Maryland state legislator from 1966 to 1970, Fornos also served as Maryland's Assistant Secretary of Human Resources and held a position in the office of the U.S. Secretary of Labor. He is a graduate of the University of Maryland with a degree in government and politics.
1982. Prior to that, he has had a long service in government. He was a former state legislator in Maryland. He has basically traveled the world over as an authority on the population issue. He has been a consultant to the United States Agency for International Development, the United States Aid Program, on population issues. His position as president of the Population Institute has been one in which he has been attempting to bring to the American people the gravity of the world population growth and the problems connected with it. And I'll turn the microphone over to Werner Fornos.
Thank you very much, Bob. I'm delighted to be back at Nebraska Wesleyan, and I look forward to spending a couple of hours, even more if we need to, until I fly back to Washington this afternoon with all of you about an issue which I think transcends the threat of nuclear war. It may sound an easy statement to say that, but let me tell you why I believe that. Hopefully, sane human beings will not push those buttons which will start off a nuclear holocaust. But the population explosion, which now sees us at a world of 5 billion people, last year having grown by 90 million people, which is larger than adding one additional country the size of Mexico, terribly torn by civil strife and social unrest and economic deprivation. And this problem is receiving so little attention that we really have to, as we look towards the 21st century and the 12 years remaining, to make it a priority concern of policy makers around the globe, especially policymakers within the 20 industrialized countries that have the wherewithal to do something about it, and the 130 countries that are suffering from massive population growth, a growth in many countries which even is beyond the resource base of those countries and is threatening the environmental quality. You may have noticed that amid all the reflections of promises at the beginning of the new year were the headlines of more hunger in Ethiopia. And it is somewhat appropriate that 1987 should have drawn to a close to the muffled cries of a new famine taking shape in Africa. We all remember the vivid television pictures from the 1985 famine, the wrenching scenes of homeless families, and everywhere the dying children. We were moved at the time to donate money or purchase special record albums that were sold for the Emergency Benefit Relief Program. You will be troubled to learn, therefore, that the starving child that your donation helped to feed is hungry again. And without a repeat of the kind of generosity and all-out effort that we saw in 1985, that child and many thousands of others will die in the new famine now shaping up. The resurgence of mass human suffering in Ethiopia and its neighboring countries, just 2 years after one of the most ambitious international aid efforts in history, underscores the fact that there is a force deep at work behind Africa's unfolding tragedy. And it is one that cannot be wished away with quick fix airlifts, benefit rock concerts, however well intended. The culprit at the heart of Ethiopia's woe is rapid population growth. And until we reckon with this formidable foe, Famine like the one now developing will continue to be cruel, frustrating, and yes, entirely foreseeable. Consider a simple calculation. Ethiopia's population, now at 46 million, is growing at a rate of 2.3% annually. At that rate, it will double itself to 92 million people in just 30 years. All of this growth is occurring despite the staggering figures of hunger and disease and the toll that they will take. Now, I don't know how much you know about Ethiopia, though I think, having been familiar with the curriculum at this institution, that you know probably more than most college students around the country. It is a land rich in culture and history, but it is also a land desperately poor in the stuff that drives a national economy: fertile soil, agricultural technology, medicine, transportation, the educational systems. And one of the things most disturbing to all of us, that this country, which at the year 1900 had 60% of the country covered with fertile ground cover, today has less than 4% of the country with green stuffs, whether it's bushes, grass, or even an occasional tree. And most of those are along the avenues in Addis Ababa, the capital. When a nation's population expands as quickly as is Ethiopia's, its ability to expand its supply of food, drinking water, jobs, housing, education, and health services had better be prepared to keep up. In Ethiopia's case, it isn't. Unfortunately, that is too much to expect of Ethiopia or dozens of other developing nations, where national agricultural output, arable land, economic vitality, and educational resources for the future are shrinking rather than growing. Surging growth in human numbers is a problem common to virtually the entire third world, and its debilitating effects are only more dramatic in Ethiopia, where it has made an especially deadly combination with drought and civil war and inept government policies. Yet it is at work in almost every developing nation, helping to overwhelm fragile security and the quality of the global environment. The number of people now inhabiting the earth, as I said at the beginning, is just over 5 billion. And when we look at the unprecedented growth, that 90 million I spoke about is larger than any annual increase we have ever experienced. When at that rate, we will therefore see, if you happen to be in Iowa or in Nebraska or any place else in the United States today, you will see that this crowded planet will double its population within 54 years, most of it within many of your lifetimes. Those of us who are balding all too fast and fighting girth control probably won't be around to see it. But within 54 years, the time when you will be looking at your children and their grandchildren to see what kind of quality of life they have. There is an especially significant characteristic of that expansion that I want you to be aware of, and that is that 92% of that population growth is taking place in the poorer developing countries of the third world, in precisely those nations that can least afford to clothe, feed, house, and care for those additions. The swelling numbers of the hungry, the homeless, and the hopeless in the third world have obvious moral implications for those of us in the position to help. These numbers also have clear, hard-nosed strategic implications for the United States and its Western industrialized allies. 40 years ago, when the United States and the Soviet Union emerged from the rubble of World War II as the undisputable superpowers on Earth, the world was largely perceived as divided between two competing spheres. There was the free world of the democratic nations, led by the United States and its European allies, and there was the communist world, dominated by the Soviet Union and its growing ring of satellite states. And beyond that, nothing else much mattered. Today, most of you would probably still identify the Soviet Union as this country's greatest security threat, but the shape of the world is changing dramatically, and it is crucial to the security of this country and to the well-being of the world as a whole that we recognize it. The world today is still largely divided between the two spheres, but those camps are now organized not according to their political orientation or their economic philosophy, so much as according to their diverging human and national fortunes. One sphere is the industrialized world, exemplified by the seven nations that meet every year in an economic summit. and the Pacific countries that are on the rim of this. This world includes both great Western democracies like the United States and many of the nations of the Soviet bloc. The other sphere is the developing world made up of nations of every cultural, political, and economic stripe, all bound together by a common yoke of poverty. Between these two worlds lies a broadening gulf of disparity. The nations of the industrial world, despite significant political differences, have in common the fact of stabilized population growth. The populations of the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, the Soviet Union, and both Eastern and Western Europe are growing slowly, if at all. All of the Nordic countries, Western Europe, Ireland, and England today have a population of 240 million people. They still will have 240 million people at the turn of the century. Nebraska today has a population of 1.6 million people, with roughly the same size of that Francophone country in Africa of Senegal. Senegal has 7.2 million people. But what you have to see, it would take Nebraska 102 years to double the population. But what we're looking at in Senegal will be doubled in just 25 years, and then again at current growth rates. With the pressures of rapid population growth, these countries are able to devote larger shares of their national economic products toward actually improving the quality of life, as we see in the European countries today. Life expectancy is being extended. Diseases are being conquered. The agricultural yield extracted from a single acre of farmland is being vastly expanded, and no one knows that better than Nebraskans. We're seeing that cities are being rebuilt. Even pollution of the environment is being reversed in some few places. In stark contrast to this picture of stabilized population growth and improving economic fortunes is the situation faced by almost all developing nations. Their population growth, despite some recent reductions, remains very high. The populations of many developing countries like Haiti, Honduras, Kenya, Iran, Jordan, and Vietnam will double their population in less than 20 years. That's less than in a single generation. Moreover, the population of the entire African continent will double in just 24 years if current growth rates are maintained. Such dizzying growth has significant social effects. Given such high birth rates, it is not surprising that the populations of the Third World are disproportionately young. In Latin America and Asia, nearly 40% of all people are under 15 years and old. In Africa, fully 45% is under age 15. And that compares with a steady 22% in the United States and Canada, and yes, here in Nebraska. These enormous and growing numbers of young people place nearly crushing strains on the educational systems, health networks, and job markets of developing countries. They also help to explain the comment of Mexican political scientist Jorge Castaneda, who said that in Mexico, most young people have three options. One, remain idle on the street, migrate to the United States, or become members of revolutionary causes. The youthful nature of the present Third World societies is also a clear warning of yet more population growth. Over the course of the next generation, and I want you to hear this figure because it's astounding, over the course of the next generation, and this includes most of you in this room, certainly the students, we will be adding 3 billion young people who will be entering their reproductive years for the first time. 3 billion young people entering their reproductive years for the first time. That's equal to the entire population of the Earth just in 1960. If the industrial world stands by and permits the developing world to careen on its present course of population explosion and social and economic disintegration, there will be a heavy price to pay. It will be a price made up not only of lives and suffering in the Third World, but also of economic decline and growing international tension for the nations of the industrial world as well. For the Earth is far too complex and interdependent a place today to ignore the fall of three-quarters of its people. The national economies of the United States and other industrial powers are inseparably entangled with the fates of developing nations where much of the international market of raw materials and consumers live. It is therefore urgently in the self-interest of the United States and its allies to help the Third World to stabilize its population growth and continue on the road toward economic development. This challenge is at least as pressing as the one this country faced in the early years of the Cold War when it perceived itself in the vital struggle to rebuild war-torn Europe in an effort to fend off the potential for a wedge of Soviet influence there. The United States rose to meet that challenge following World War II in the form of the Marshall Plan, which remains today one of America's greatest and more far-sighted foreign policy victories. What is needed today is a radical overhaul of the humanitarian aid policies of most industrialized nations. There is a fundamental inadequacy to the way this country and others like it respond to the humanitarian needs of the developing world. Usually we provide a bare trickle of aid to most third world capitals, just enough to keep the American flag visible, but not quite enough to really affect the course of development. Then we wait for the kind of large-scale disaster now brewing again in Ethiopia, and at the appropriate moment rush onto the scene with shipments of emergency food aid, when most of the starving have already been condemned. This kind of fire department approach is employed by many of the major donor nations, and it results in duplication of effort, administrative inefficiency, waste, and not least of all, resentment among the people that we come to help. To compound the problem, money for humanitarian aid programs has all but vanished from the U.S. budget in recent times. Consider the fiscal 1988 spending plan approved by Congress late last month. In a massive appropriations bill passed in the twilight hours before the Christmas recess, I was there until 4 o'clock in the morning on December 21st, trying to push for a balance in population assistance, Congress decided how much money this country will spend on all foreign aid programs in the coming year. Of the $6.2 billion amount allocated for the U.S. Agency for International Development, only about half that is available for flexible program initiatives in what is called the Emergency Support Fund. Of the $3.2 billion in that account, Congress wrote into the bill special earmarks for pet projects of favored U.S. allies. $1.2 billion was taken right off the top for Israel. Small amounts were then deducted for other priority nations, including $850 million for Egypt, $220 million for Pakistan, $174 million for the Philippines. Four Central American countries received $440 million, and Ireland. Then came money set aside for the favorite causes of selected congressmen, among them funds for the Solidarity Labor Movement in Poland and for rebels fighting the Soviet-backed insurrection in Afghanistan. Taking into consideration those designated funds, we are left with just $99 million with which the U.S. Agency for International Development, the government's foreign assistance agency, can undertake important bilateral aid programs. And agency officials say most of that shrinking amount will go in economic aid to NATO allies, where we have costly base rights bills to pay. Turkey, Spain, Portugal. With what is left over, the agency is supposed to satisfy literally a world of need in 100 other countries. Many of the projects written into the bill may well be worthy. But the total amount budgeted is just plain too small to meet this country's security needs. And what that leaves over for genuine humanitarian assistance to countries on the brink is just about equal to the change I'm carrying in my pocket today. The plan which I propose today at Nebraska Wesleyan calls for a completely new direction in humanitarian assistance. It calls for cooperation among the world's donor nations to direct valuable aid dollars to where they are needed most. It calls for a reorientation of aid programs away from projects whose chief benefit is showing the donor nation's flag, to projects whose chief beneficiaries are poor people in need. Finally, it calls for increased spending and planning by the donor nations in order to address the fundamental problems crippling the third world, rather than throwing 50,000 or 100,000 at a time at each country with a debilitating crisis. What I'm urging today is that America and the other nations of the industrial world rise to meet what is surely the challenge of this generation, to revitalize the struggling economies and put an end to the large-scale human tragedies of the third world. Because for all the woes of the developing world related to population growth, perhaps the most tragic of all, that this most comprehensive of human challenges is also one of the most easily solved ones. It means that we have to, when we hear budget figures and calling for more spending, in this case, what we have to sacrifice is 1 6-pack a year. 1 6-pack a year to fulfill the plan that I spell out here today, whether it happens to be a soft drink 6-pack or your favorite beer Or yes, even a four-pack of Bartles and James with a little personality thrown in. Too often, we become obsessed with fighting the symptoms, hunger, unemployment, inflation, environmental decay, and social justice, revolution, rather than focusing on the disease itself. My proposal would begin to remedy that problem if the 20 richest nations on earth were to adopt the 20 nations with the fastest growing populations and undertake measures contained in this four-point plan, the world would no longer have a population problem by the end of this century. Such an effort could fairly be called, for the lack of anything else, a Marshall Plan for the 90s, because like that heroic aid plan, the aim is providing structural relief leading to self-sufficiency. Also like the Marshall Plan, this package would be extraordinarily cost-efficient by preventing the foreseeable human crises of the next generation. And yet the stakes are much larger. Here we stand to rescue not just war-ravaged Europe, but the entire Third World. Now, this new Marshall Plan is built around four primary objectives. Some of them may surprise you, because when we talk about population issues, we simply focus upon sexual reproduction. But there are a lot of other issues involved. Number one in that plan is dramatically increasing female literacy in the developing world. Number two, dramatically increasing employment opportunities for women in the developing world, reducing infant mortality rates, and achieving the universal availability of family planning. The efforts to achieve these goals would be concentrated in the world's 20 fastest growing countries, nations that together account for 69% of the population growth in the world today. Therefore, if population growth can be stabilized in these 20 nations, the world's battle will be largely won, and stabilization can be gradually extended to all world's countries. These nations include, and they're almost easy for you to tick off, but let's just make them for the record, Bangladesh, Brazil, Burma, China, Egypt, Ethiopia, India, Indonesia, Iran, Kenya, Mexico, Nigeria, Pakistan, the Philippines, South Korea, Tanzania, Thailand, Turkey, Vietnam, and Zaire. These efforts would be financed primarily by contributions from a very different collection of nations, the 20 richest on Earth. These nations identified by a calculation of high per capita income and a population base sufficient to contribute to such a program include Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Finland, France, Great Britain, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Saudi Arabia, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Arab Emirates, the United States, and West Germany. Having identified the immediate beneficiary countries and the most logical financiers, who would themselves, of course, be the secondary beneficiaries of this plan, allow me to explain briefly the four points through which we would achieve our ambitious goal of stabilizing world population growth. The first two of the plan's four objectives require long-term efforts to increase literacy and employment opportunities for women in the Third World. These two goals may be discussed together because they almost always go hand in hand. There is a truth that cuts across cultures and continents. Where women are offered a real choice about their futures and given enough education to seize it, they almost invariably opt for a smaller family size. That decision is the first, most important ingredient necessary to conquering the world's skyrocketing population growth. The problem is not that women are kept from working. Far from it. Females do 80% of all agricultural work in Africa today. The problem is that women are too often denied the kinds of jobs that offer sufficient satisfaction and reward to present a meaningful alternative to their traditional roles as wife, mother, and family laborer. As proof, consider that woman today, consider the fact that women today do 2/3 of the world's work, earn 1/10 of the world's income, and own less than 1% of the world's property. Part of the problem is outright discrimination, but perhaps a larger part of the problem is ingrained in cultural traditions. The nation of Zimbabwe in Central Africa provides a common example. According to Sally Mugabe, the wife of the prime minister of that country, and I now quote from here, she says, Zimbabwean women live within the context of a local culture that views procreation and reproduction in metaphysical terms. Every person is considered to be spiritually impure and is not permitted to participate in spiritual affairs until after siring or bearing an offspring. For a woman, bearing and rearing children is the primary source of her status in the family and community. The larger the number of children a woman has, the higher the status she enjoys. Some communities perform elaborate ceremonies to honor women on bearing their 10th child. End of Sally Mugabe's quote. So long as girls and women are prevented or discouraged from aspiring for something more than motherhood, there will be rapid population growth. So long as cultures raise their young girls to view bearing a child as a necessary rite of passage to adulthood, girls will choose to become mothers too early, and the earlier a couple begins to have children, the longer they will have to continue having children. And yet, in nations which have opened up the schoolhouse and the workplace to women, fertility rates have uniformly declined. This has certainly been the case in the United States and other industrialized nations. Most of you, I suspect, have made a decision, conscious or unconscious, to put off having children because of the educational opportunities that brought you to Nebraska Wesleyan. It is really not significantly different in the third world. It is no coincidence that the countries with the highest fertility rates are also those with the most restrictive roles for women. It is also telling that those third world countries where fertility rates are beginning to stabilize, places like Thailand, South Korea, Mexico, and Brazil, are also witnessing expanding educational and employment opportunities for women. Admitting girls into public schools and offering them a chance at a worthwhile job once they graduate helps curb population growth in several ways. First, education helps to reorient girls and boys, for that matter, away from the cultural emphasis on childbearing, like the one that we see in Zimbabwe. It helps children realize their potential for other forms of status and expression and gives them the skills necessary to make other life choices. Second, when girls stay in school longer, and then again when they enter the job market, they very often delay marriage. The World Fertility Survey, the largest social science project ever undertaken, not by an American institution, by an institution located in The Hague called the International Statistical Institute, did a massive survey of 41 countries. It was primarily funded by the United Nations Population Fund and found that the two greatest factors influencing the average age at which a young woman married were employment and educational opportunities for a woman. The survey found that in developing nations that had extended primary education for teenage girls, the average age at first marriage rose. By the same token, societies expanding employment opportunities for young women also experienced rising ages at first marriage. Conversely, the survey found that in societies without enlarged educational and employment opportunities for girls and women, females continued to marry at very young ages, in many countries being married off at the age of 11. The tie between rapid population growth and early marriage is powerful. The nations of the third world now making progress in lowering fertility rates have each done so only in concert with rising average age at marriage. In Bangladesh, for example, where high fertility rates have been slow to subside, most girls have already become brides by the age of 13. Now, this is slightly higher than the 11 I just mentioned. That was just two decades ago. In economically booming South Korea, with a population of 42 million people and the lowest natural growth rate of any major country in Asia of only 1.4%, the average age at first marriage has risen from 17.8 several decades ago to roughly 23 years old today. The relationship between education and age at marriage may seem even more dramatic within a single community. In 1980, researchers studied marriage and fertility patterns in the Indian state of Kerala. By the way, India is today growing at the rate of 2 million people a month. They discovered that most girls without any schooling were already married and having children by age 17. For those women who had attended school for 9 or more years, however, the average age at marriage was upwards of 22 years old. And finally, with more education, women are less apt to rush into motherhood or to find themselves there by mistake. For one thing, study after study following release of the World Fertility Survey data showed that women with some formal education had higher success rates in using contraceptives and were therefore more likely to continue using them. One 1984 study of education and fertility in Bangladesh, for example, found that contraceptive use among women who had never attended school was confined to only 8%. That figure climbed to 42%, however, among Bangladeshi women with at least a secondary education. That finding has been mirrored in regional studies, and the consistency in result has supported macro-level conclusions. Educated women are far less likely to misunderstand, misuse, or give up contraceptives. Consequently, the World Fertility Survey found a consistent pattern of decreasing fertility hand-in-hand with increasing education among third world women. In Sudan, for example, women without any formal education had an average of 6.5 children each. Yet Sudanese women with between 4 and 6 years of education had an average of 5 children each. And with 7 or more years of schooling, that dropped to 3.4 children per woman. The disparity was even more vivid in Mexico, where uneducated women had, at the time of the survey was taken, an average of 8 children. An average of 8 children. Remember, infant mortality and maternal mortality is very high in these countries. Mexican women, however, with 7 years or more of education, had an average of only 2.7 children. Somewhat interestingly, a number of the studies have suggested that fertility actually rises slightly for women exposed to 1 or 2 years of primary education before falling sharply for women with more years of schooling. At first, this rise might seem to support that old adage, a little education can be dangerous. Actually, however, the most plausible explanation for this aberration is that women with a couple of years of education have somewhat more success in keeping their babies alive through improved prenatal care and proper health care following the birth. Thus, the slight increase probably reflects the effect of education in depressing the infant mortality rate rather than its effect in encouraging fertility per se. The most significant drop in fertility comes for those women who have had 8 years or more of formal education. It is for this reason that the plan I've outlined today calls for at least an 8th grade education for all women. Employment opportunities also benefit women and generally lead to decline in fertility. To some extent, lower fertility levels among women employed outside the home may simply reflect the lower fertility levels found among educated women, since working women are most likely to be educated women. Yet there seems to be something more at work exerting a downward pressure on fertility among employed women. One factor is the wider access working women are likely to have to birth control. Third world women employed outside the home are more likely to reside in urban centers, where access to family planning services is generally better than in rural areas. Also, it is significant that work-based family planning clinics are becoming the rule of the day rather than the exception, and that employers realize the practical advantages of efficiencies of supplying birth control information and supplies through the workplace. At bottom, the relationship between lower fertility and wider employment opportunities for women is difficult to dispute. A number of regional and national studies have reached conclusions similar to the one published in 1983 by the Journal of Comparative Studies. That study found that women in Bogota, Colombia, who worked outside the home, married later, had fewer children, and allowed longer intervals between births than their non-working neighbors. If all these statistics have numbed you somewhat, I might let the effects wear off by leaving you with a final nugget of common sense linking increased opportunities for women with smaller average family size. The toll of childbearing in the third world is staggering. 1,400 women die daily from complications related to pregnancy. And that does not take into account that many more suffer from impaired health or poor nutrition as a result of the strain of childbirth. Since it is women who bear the burden of pregnancy, its attendant health risks, and the primary burden of childbearing, it is entirely reasonable that if given a fuller choice, many women might choose to delay to avoid future pregnancies. The third effort called for in this plan is one to lower the terrible infant and child mortality rates now common in the developing world. Now, there has been justifiable concern about the AIDS epidemic that's creeping up in many countries around the world, the worst, of course, being in our own country, with just today us realizing that as a result of the count by the Center for Disease Control that was delivered to the London conference, that there are now over 55,000 cases of AIDS virus in the United States. We don't know precisely the number of AIDS-related deaths that there have been in the last 2 years. In the United States, it's been 28,000. But the United Nations Children Fund estimates that it is less than the 70,000 children that died from diarrhea this week while I was here in Nebraska and in Iowa. 70,000 children died from diarrhea. Certainly it is less than the 2 years combined deaths that have occurred on AIDS causes. However, since AIDS affects the adult population, we become significantly alarmed rather than at the deaths of infants. The United Nations Children Fund predicts that in Africa, the Near East, and Asia, we will see a continuation of the figures that came about in 1987, that 42,000 children died daily under the age of one. 42,000 children dying daily under the age of one. That amounts to 14 million child deaths, and that breaks down roughly 5 million from diarrhea, 4 million died from upper respiratory infections, and 3 million died from the causes of malaria. All of them eradicable diseases that have long ago been imagined by us to have been conquered. Now, on the global scale alone, can you imagine that? 15 million children this coming year, 14 million children in the last year dying before they reach their first year of life. Given such a high incidence of early death, many parents in the third world perceive an incentive to have more children than they actually desire in order to insure against the possible loss of one or more of their children before adulthood. This tendency was borne out in a recent study of national fertility trends in Egypt. Women who had lost a child to early death were found to have an average of 3.5 more children than those who didn't have an early death in the child. Millions of dollars are spent trying to save children from early death through oral rehydration therapy. By the way, it costs 10 cents a package. Improved nutrition and encouraging mothers to breastfeed their infants. Yet the very people who are in charge of these programs acknowledge that there is a superior method of saving these lives, in fact, a way of ensuring healthy babies from the start, and that method is better family planning. Half of the 50 million annual deaths, as I mentioned to you, could have been prevented. And we've seen that in the World Fertility Survey, that in the 41 countries studied, infant mortality rates were significantly lower for those children who were born at least 2 years apart after their next oldest sibling. In many of those countries, Indonesia, South Korea, Thailand, the Philippines, Colombia, Peru as examples, a child's chances of survival doubled if the mother waited 2 years between pregnancies. In Jordan, Syria, Tunisia, and Yemen, a child's life chances tripled if the mother used proper child spacing. The enormous benefits of child spacing for child and maternal health have led UNICEF to identify family planning as, quote, one of the most important single steps which can now be taken toward reducing infant mortality and increasing the health of both mothers and children. Even more recently, Dr. James Grant, UNICEF's executive director, speaking before the International Conference on Better Health for Mothers and Children, estimated that more than 200,000 mothers who will die in childbirth this year could be saved if they were given the information and the means to better space their children. It follows then that in its 1988 State of the World's Children Report, UNICEF concluded, even if there were no such thing as a population problem, the decision of so many millions of families to begin timing their births of their children by various methods and according to their own traditions and values would still rank as one of this century's greatest contributions to the well-being of the human family. It's interesting to note that along with family planning, the other clearest factor influencing a child's survival chances is the educational level of the mother. Thus, the first point raised in this comprehensive plan I'm proposing, the call to extend educational opportunities for women, will contribute directly toward the achievement of the plan's third objective, the reduction of infant mortality in the developing world. If you were to put all the nations of the world on a chart according to their infant mortality rates and their levels of female literacy and education, what you would find is a striking consistency linking increasing maternal education with decreasing child mortality. The nations with the lowest levels of female educational opportunities are also those with the highest infant mortality rates, and the nations where women are fully integrated into education also have the lowest incidence of infant mortality. It will probably not surprise you to learn, therefore, that a recent study published by the World Health Organization found that Latin American children born to illiterate mothers are 5 times more likely to perish in childhood than those born to mothers with at least 5 years of schooling. An intensive study by the same organization of child mortality in Peru confirmed the findings and concluded that after proper child spacing, the educational level of the mother was by far the most significant determinant of a child's life chances, even after controlling for other variables like available medical facilities and public sanitation. All of this makes a great deal of common sense, of course. Mothers with more education are more knowledgeable, both about the important benefits of proper child spacing and about means of caring for their child's nutritional and basic health needs. But the strong correlation between female education, lower child death rates, and slower overall population growth should spur us on in realizing the importance of these coordinated efforts. The fourth and final effort called for in this comprehensive strategy to stabilize world population growth is achieving the universal availability of medically approved methods of family planning and its education and their means. All of the other efforts to give women choices and couples security in planning their family size will have very little meaning, of course, if they do not have access to family planning advice or contraceptives. If couples continue to lack the knowledge and services to actually implement their choices, little will be changed. For this reason, it is imperative that the 20 richest nations must substantially increase their efforts in international family planning assistance. There simply can be no question about the need. The same World Fertility Survey that I quoted just a moment ago has found that there are today some 500 million women in the third world who did not want any more children. Many of them didn't want their last child, but they lacked the education and the means to implement that basic human right guaranteed by the UN Charter. Moreover, the survey found that about half of all married women of reproductive age in the third world would have even held off on the next to the last pregnancy they had. And when you realize that many of them are having 15 and 16 pregnancies, and young women 25 years of age looking like they're over 50, having 9 children already in most Asian countries, you can see the cultural disparity that we're talking about today. With less than two-thirds of the population in the third world having access to effective birth control, and in most of Africa and the Middle East, less than 15 out of every 100 people having the ability to have access to effective birth control, that really tells us something. It means that a great many of those married women who said that they want no more children, who said that they are too tired or ill, or whose family resources are already stretched too thin, are due for yet another unwanted pregnancy. And every day the problem grows more acute. By the year 2000, unless you think we're talking something about very, very far away, just a dozen years away from now, the number of people in the reproductive years will have increased by 50%. Against this backdrop of rising need is a portrait of dangerous inaction by the United States and other countries that are in a position to help. The United States was for 20 years the undisputed international leader in providing population assistance to the third world. Before many of the countries themselves realized the full implications of their dilemmas, the United States was there with information, advice, and supply to developing nations. Supplies that averted the increasingly obvious effects of rapid population growth. In time, virtually the entire third world came to realize the dangers inherent in continued population explosion, and other industrialized nations also responded generously to the call for help. The happy result of that global cooperative effort was that population growth rates in many third world countries began to subside somewhat. Progress was slow, but definite. Family planning was taking hold. 48 sub-Saharan African country leaders have now appealed to the United Nations for help in this very critical and personal field. Yet, at precisely the time that this is occurring, the United States again should be asserting its leadership role and capitalizing on the investments it has made over the past two decades. It is hesitating. Over the past 2 years, U.S. spending on international population assistance programs has fallen by 20%, dropping from $288 million in 1985 to $220 million in 1988. At least as bad, the administration has allowed itself to be confused and misled by zealots who do not understand the nature and purpose of family planning assistance. As a result, the United States has made two very harmful decisions in the fight to moderate population growth. It has withdrawn its traditional financial support from the United Nations Population Fund and from the International Planned Parenthood Federation, the two most effective providers of family planning services in the third world. The record of 20 years of active efforts to curb rapid population growth show emphatically that the third world is receptive to well-managed, cost-effective, locally oriented and designed programs that extend voluntary family planning services consistent with the cultural settings of recipient countries. The need is there. The technology is readily available to meet that need, and that technology is improving every single day. What is lacking is the political resolve and the leadership to mobilize that technology and get it to where it's needed. We are today at a critical junction. The nations of the earth are being remolded by powerful demographic forces, and there's a growing schism between rich and poor, the contented and the hungry, the complacent and the frustrated. This widening breach is rich in implications for the future stability and peace of this globe and the prosperity of nations, as much as for those where the problems of overpopulation are now festering. The reports of a new famine developing in Ethiopia, as full as they are of stories of widespread suffering, are but a small manifestation of these forces. We cannot continue to deal with these problems piecemeal, or we can adopt a more far-sighted approach rather than the piecemeal approach. If the industrialized nations will join those third world nations with the fastest growing populations to take up the hard but rewarding work of realizing the four goals I've outlined this morning, the world can set aside the drama of emergency airlift once and for all in favor of a lasting humanitarian solution. 40 years ago, Secretary of State George C. Marshall rose to his feet before the graduating class at Harvard College and sounded a warning. Nations vital to U.S. and democratic interests were in peril, and he offered a plan for constructive action that was both humanitarian and strategically in America's self-interest. Marshall said, "The patient is sinking while the doctors deliberate." Today, we are the doctors who are summoned to save the life of a patient stricken with a grave but entirely curable disease. Just as in Marshall's time, the need for action is critical, and the time for deliberation is over. Planning assistance. That legislation was carried forward in the Senate by Charles Percy and J. William Fulbright, and it became the law of the land. When he was our ambassador to the United Nations, he consistently supported the United Nations Population Fund and cited it as one of the most efficient and humanitarian efforts we could be undertaking. When he was the head of the CIA, he caused several top secret studies to be made on the threat to U.S. international security interests, which then became the National Security Council decision memorandum, which Jerry Ford signed, saying that this was one of the major cornerstones of U.S. foreign policy. So that's Bush. But since then, we don't know what's happened to him. But as I understand, he won't comment about what he thinks. He's the vice president. We'll see what he does should he be successful. In the Democratic side, Paul Simon, throughout his time in the House and his time in the Senate, has consistently been in the forefront of issues of women's rights, family planning, and international humanitarian efforts that shifts money out of the arsenals of the world into the mouths of babes. So certainly his record is among the best of the Democratic candidates. But when you listen to the debates, all of them have said that they would be in favor of supporting international population efforts.
Today, University Forum has presented Werner Fornos, president of the Population Institute, Washington, D.C. His topic was Gaining People, Losing Ground. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.